From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a package of bills requiring financial disclosures from state lawmakers is stalled in a House committee, making Michigan an outlier.
47 other states have decided to require some form of disclosure so people have a minimum level of information about where people are making money.
The clock's ticking on homeowners in Wayne County who got tax foreclosure notices. They've got till June 7th to either pay or get help.
Detroiters see their president taking advantage of every tax break, so they feel they're entitled to do that too.
And we look at the work being done by the Flint Institute of Arts.
It's our intention to bring the finest quality art experiences to the entire community. All ages, all walks of life, all backgrounds.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Should state lawmakers be required to file a financial disclosure statement? Something to let constituents know if there are potential problems, conflicts of interest. 47 states say yes, and they have some law on the books that requires legislators to file some sort of financial disclosure statement. The three exceptions: Vermont, Idaho, and Michigan. A recent Detroit News story tells us, even with a nod from Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly and from House Speaker Tom Leonard, a package of bills that would require our state lawmakers to disclose their personal financial information is stalled in a House committee. Craig Mauger of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network is here with us now. Craig, we're talking about a package of bills introduced a couple of months back by Senate and House Democrats. What's in the package?
It's kind of a wide-ranging package, but the main proposal that people are kind of focused on is this idea of whether state lawmakers should have to file some type of disclosure about their outside income. So this is money they're making or groups that they're affiliated with outside of their work in the state legislature. So that could be, you know, rental housing that they sell or make money off of on the side. It could be a side business that they have. And some lawmakers maintain their full-time business while serving in the legislature as well. So it could be a small amount of money or it could be a very large amount of money.
So why is this so critical? Could you give us some real-life examples of why this matters?
Yeah, well, why it matters is that in order to have a democracy that is functioning, voters need at least a minimum level of information about who they're voting on. You know, state legislators who talk about this will say, you know, if my voters don't like what I'm doing, they will vote me out. And that's often their defense on this subject, which is a fair defense. But this whole thing is about giving people the information on which to make decisions. You know, as someone who was a journalist covering the Capitol day to day here, we often have no idea what these guys are doing on these sides. These men and women, we have no idea what they're doing when they're not on the House floor or the Senate floor, who they're working for, who they're selling things to. And to not have that information, we don't have a full scope to really look at the decisions that they're making on behalf of their constituents, because they're here to work on behalf of their constituents. You know, just looking over these things, information that we have been able to gather over the last couple of years from, you know, various means, you know, we've had lawmakers who are married to lobbyists who are working on proposals that they're also working on in the legislature. MLive did a piece on a state lawmaker who was the chair of a committee, Ray Franz, and he was hearing testimony from someone who was working for a company from which he was also working on a land deal with. So there are all these different things that kind of intertwine here, and you don't know them often unless a journalist really takes time to look into them or unless it makes someone angry and that person decides to leak it. So there is this just huge mystery around all of these things, and it all happens in the dark. And at the same time, while that is happening, 47 other states have decided to require some form of disclosure so people have a minimum level of information about where people are making money.
And indeed, the federal government has pretty detailed financial disclosure requirements. If you want to run for Congress, what's required?
They have to give information about, you know, real estate they own, all of the outside income. They have to give information on their stock holdings. You know, the idea here is that these people are making decisions that affect these companies, that affect all of these things, and people should know from the get-go where their interests lie financially in these things. And a lot of our state lawmakers, when they file to run for Congress, that's the only time that we get real insight into where their financial interests were while they were serving in the state legislature.
And these financial disclosure bills were referred to the House Elections and Ethics Committee. How is it faring?
It sounds like, from what the Detroit News reported today, that the chair of the committee, Representative Aaron Miller, is not on board with these bills. So when a committee chair is not on board with these bills, often that will mean that those bills aren't going anywhere. And even if they did go somewhere in the House, the Senate is very opposed to these type of disclosure bills as well.
What about the argument that Representative Miller and other critics say, hey, these disclosures can get too personal or too private? Why should someone who wants to run for the legislature in the state have to disclose all their family's financial businesses?
You know, the counter argument to that would be that this is a duty that you have to your constituents. No one is forcing these people to run for the legislature. This is a choice that they're making, and they're making a salary from the public. And it's only fair to provide the public some information about the things that you're doing on the side. You know, we don't have a part-time legislature here. This is supposed to be these lawmakers' full-time jobs. And if they have other jobs on the side, it's only right to disclose that information about where that money is coming from to their constituents. Another reason that these are so important is something that we saw play out in Utah this year. The Salt Lake Tribune used personal financial disclosures to determine that one in every four bills sponsored in their legislature could be traced from the lawmaker sponsoring them to that lawmaker having some type of deep professional or personal interest in the bill. They were able to do this research, and you can look the story up, only because they had these personal financial disclosures. We have nothing like that here, and no way to do that type of analysis, and no way to figure this out.
So now what?
So now what? It's where we've been for a long time. We're one of three states that doesn't have this type of disclosure. And until, you know, the legislature is willing to do something about it, we will be one of the three states. And at the same time, we rank 50th out of all 50 states, as we've talked about previously, when it comes to systems for deterring corruption. And that's from the Center for Public Integrity. And this is one of the major reasons that we're 50th out of 50.
And for folks interested in learning more about money in Michigan politics, you've got an event happening later in this week. What's going on?
Yeah, definitely. So on Thursday night, our group, the Michigan Campaign Finance Network, and a couple of other groups based in Lansing are going to be having a forum on money in politics. It's an educational forum. We're going to have a panel discussion so people can learn more about these issues. We'll be talking about, you know, campaign finance. We'll be talking about lobbying and things like that. And we're just going to present information so people can get some insight on this. And it's going to be at Midtown Brewing Company at 7:30 Thursday. So it should be a really fun event as well.
You can get the details by going to the Michigan Campaign Finance Network website, mcfn.org. As always, Craig Mauger, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We spoke with the Office of Representative Aaron Miller, the Republican chair of the House Elections and Ethics Committee, hoping to talk with him and get his take. They did not get back to us about setting up an interview. Set in Michigan's small towns, both real and fictional, the stories in Laura Hulthan Thomas's collection take place against a backdrop of economic turmoil and the domestic cost of the war on terror. Her stories follow blue collars and white, cops and immigrants, and mothers and sons as they defend a world that's quickly vanishing. Writer Gloria Whelan has this review.
Thomas generously gives us the whole messy life. This is deeply satisfying. But you have to pay attention. In this story, An Uneven Recovery, two women, Helen and Gina, are chatting over a backyard fence and were off and running. We learn the two women dislike but use each other, that following the real estate crash, Gina's marriage is a shambles and there is no money. More, there is a long history between Gina and her father who abandoned her mother and is now enamored of a 22-year-old fortune teller. Somehow, despite all of this, Thomas finds a way for at least a little happiness. And so suspect, Perry's daughter and her friend have disappeared. Perry, who had been raising the daughter on his own, is a suspect and is shunned by his community. 20 years go by, and the car with the two girls, is discovered in a lake. The girls had been drowned. What is the connection between the drowning and the man Perry comes upon night after night, huddled in the middle of the road? Why is the man longing to be run over? In this psychological mystery, the story is not quite what it seems. The story Lab Will Care is set in a university laboratory. Emily, struggling to preserve the goals of a research study, confronts the lab's director, who is manipulating the study to benefit his daughter's illness. At the same time, Emily has an old friend, Dinah, who is now an animal rights activist and threatening the lab. Dinah once seduced a man Emily cared for, and now Dinah has come back for her friend's help in that man's disintegrating life. The titular story, States of Motion, begins with the children's Olympiad competition. There's elicited love in a custodial closet and the traumatic death of a dog. Moore and her husband Ivan both endured painful childhoods in their native Russia. They are in the States now and safe, but their lingering fear still touches everything in their lives. Moore is unable to say the words, "It'll be okay." Thomas, whose stories have appeared in a number of literary journals, heads the undergraduate creative writing program at the University of Michigan's Residential College. Her many Michigan settings are varied, detailed, and familiar to us. She is adept at giving us a character in a few words. They feel like people we have all known. Their thoughts have often been our thoughts, and their secrets not far from our own.
Gloria Whelan won the National Book Award for her young adult novel, Homeless Bird. Her fiction has appeared in Prize Stories, O. Henry Awards, and her short story collection, Living Together, was a four-word review finalist. Her review is part of the ongoing series, Michigan Bookmark. You'll find this one and others on our website, michiganradio.org. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Creation.
Curiosity.
The next idea.
We weren't setting out to do these huge things. We were just starting with solving a problem we hoped a few other people had.
You can't have a successful entrepreneurial community without money. And that's exactly why venture capitalists play such a critical role in helping Michigan startups get up and running. A new report from the Michigan Venture Capital Association tells us 54 startups in our state got more than $222 million from Michigan VC firms last year, and that's up 42% from the previous 5 years. We hear that term venture capitalist a lot. We get that they help the economy and they create opportunities. But how many of us really know what they do and how they do it? So let's get a crash course in Venture Capitalism 101. With us now, Evan Ufer with Plymouth Growth Partners of Ann Arbor, and from Invest Detroit Ventures, Adrian Omer. Welcome to both of you to The Next Idea.
Thank you.
So glad to have you here. So let's start right at square one. I'm going to toss this one to you first of all. Adrian, what do venture capitalists do?
Our core job is to find really interesting opportunities, different companies that are doing really interesting things broadly, and decide whether or not we want to invest in them and help them grow so that they can hopefully one day make a lot of product or services and eventually create money.
And when you're looking around, what criteria do you look for, you know, deciding just what companies that you want to invest in, Evan?
Sure. So we're in the growth stage world, and so we're looking for companies that have proven commercialization. So these are not typically at a whiteboard with an idea. These are companies that have real customers that sell a product or a service that have demonstrated traction and a business model that works. And ultimately, even at the stage that we're at, you're investing in people. And so you're looking for a great experienced team that's done it before and that you're aligned with.
So the seed has been planted, the little plant is poking its head up through the ground, and you're going to water it.
Correct. And at the end of the day, we're partnering with these firms to help them grow their businesses. That's ultimately what a venture capitalist is doing.
And Adrian, you come in at a little bit of a different stage. Tell us what you do.
Yeah, I'm much earlier than Evan. So we're the ones finding the seeds and planting them and hopefully getting just a little bit of water to get them to sprout. And so that requires just a little bit different of a view of the world.
And what is that? What do you mm-hmm. look for then?
Yeah, so I mean, people run it, right? It's even if an idea is phenomenal and there's great technology associated with it, if they don't see the world in a different way than kind of me or anyone else, then it's really hard to kind of believe this vision of the world that may or may not exist today.
So you want disruptors, you want people that look outside the parameters and look beyond.
Yeah, we want someone who just sees something going differently in the world, and it doesn't currently exist today. And you have to plant a lot of those seeds to figure out which ones actually can grow. And so we are super active across the state to find those seeds. Just get them into the ground. Let's see if they can even sprout.
You know, for instance, what kind of companies might we be talking about? What kind of efforts?
Yeah. So, you know, one of my most recent favorite ones specifically is a team here based in Ann Arbor, a company called Work It Health that, you know, the two founders were both former alcoholics, met in AA. AA worked for them, but they saw a number of their friends dying from alcoholism and addiction issues. And they asked themselves the question, is there a way to genuinely disrupt AA, right? And give people another option that's not, one, abstinence-based, and two, actually meets them where they are in terms of mobile world, on their computers, through work maybe. And when they came to us, it was an idea. They had made some whiteboards, so they'd sketched out some cool stuff. But when we met them, and it's two female founders too, which is another kind of added differentiation for them. And when we met them, they were having a rough time finding people who believed their vision of the world, either because those people weren't alcoholics or didn't understand the problem kind of intimately. And I think too, because they were two women, had some rough experiences trying to get that money. And so, you know, we love them. We absolutely believe them, mostly because they experienced the problem themselves.
So
it was genuine.
They'd lived it.
They lived it.
But they were looking at it from a completely different point of view.
Yeah. And so we just absolutely love them, funded them very early in their life, and now have gone on, you know, to raise a significant amount of more money, getting into businesses. Yeah. You know, businesses are now offering Work It Health as a product for their employees through employee wellness programs. So we're like making real revenue, you know, have raised real money, both from Michigan and the East Coast and the West Coast now. And so, but they're here in Michigan, you know.
And Evan, give me a sense of somebody who's been further along in the cycle that you consider a success story.
Yeah, and the companies that folks like Adrian are fostering that growth, when they hit that point, and I know the company and know the entrepreneurs that he's talking about, when they hit that point of real customers and real growth is when someone like us will come in with a little bit more significant amount of capital to kind of get them to that next stage.
You have deeper pockets.
Yes.
You guys have.
Well, we have a larger fund, but also we're focused on a little bit later stage businesses, and those often do require more capital to go hire the next great team and help them with their sales and marketing efforts. And so the kind of companies that Adrian is talking about is exactly where we play as well. It's a lot of technology businesses. It's cloud-based businesses, it's software, it's IT services, it's a bunch of some of the buzzword things that you're talking about, but ones that have actually found commercialization. So you hear about, you know, the Internet of Things, and you hear about big data, and you hear about cloud-based companies, and those are often the ones that are kind of disrupting. So in a similar way, a recent one that we worked on that's based in Detroit is in the marketing technology space, and they provide kind of advertising technology around offers. So if you're a company that wants to get to the next group of people, and so you have your existing list of customers, but you want to take that existing list of customers and ramp that up to multiples of that amount, they provide these offers. And so they provide this offer, you'll get it on your phone, and then you can share it on social media channels and offer it to all of your friends. And so there's this kind of viral, very quick impact to a business. And they're, you know, again, in a somewhat disruptive way, where traditional advertising is very hard to prove your ROI, your return on investment for that advertising dollars, this company can prove an amazing return on dollars spent. And so you have these giant Fortune 500 companies spending a lot of money with this relatively small but successful startup in the Detroit area to help them grow their businesses. And so you have giant companies that are, you know, publicly traded, spending tons of money on this Detroit company because they've proven it.
We're getting a crash course in Venture Capitalism 101 as we talk with Evan Ufer from Plymouth Growth Partners of Ann Arbor and from Invest Detroit Ventures, Adrian Omer. And I think the thing that most civilians do not get at all is, where do you get the money from?
Yeah. No, and, you know, I think every fund will have a little bit of a different story about where they get their money. But broadly speaking, you know, you get it either from institutional capital, which is a sexier word for rich institutions, you know, pension funds, you know, people who manage a lot of money, and or rich people, right, who have extra money they want to invest. So those are generally the mix, you know, and how those break down are, you know, kind of just inside lingo. But it's generally a mix of rich people and rich institutions. And so for us, you know, it's a mixture of certain foundation money and also kind of rich people who have invested in us, taking a bet on us in the same way we're taking a bet on these companies.
And for funds like Adrian's as well as ours that are either state-focused, kind of locally focused, or regionally focused, all of our investors at the end of the day have to care about this region.
Yeah.
So if they're institutions and foundations, they care about job growth, or they care about, you know, having their underlying customers get the financial wherewithal to grow and to foster job growth and all of that stuff. And then from the high net worth individual side, those folks are almost always from Michigan or went to Michigan. And so there's a lot of places to put your capital these days if you have money and you have people calling on you all the time. So you have to care about this region, and especially in Michigan, to come into our fund, which has the same mix of institutions and high net worth individuals, or Adrian's fund, which is a little more locally focused.
Mm-hmm. What don't you invest in? Like brick and mortar shops, for instance?
Yes, we don't invest in brick and mortar. Okay. And I think that for us is, you know, always going to be a challenge because of how early we invest, because we are finding those seeds. Mm-hmm. And you see incredibly successful brick and mortar bakeries and awesome little shops popping up, especially in Ann Arbor and Detroit, where you just kind of have this rebirth of kind of really creative capital kind of coming in, but we don't. For our money to go to work, it's not efficient to be investing in those brick and mortar businesses, especially when banks and bank loans kind of play a place there.
How about you guys?
It's similar. So most of our capital is going into product and services businesses, a lot for the same reason. You hear this term about capital efficiency. We care tremendously about where a company has gotten versus kind of how much capital they've raised. So a lot of the teams that are the most impressive to us have bootstrapped for a long time. They have self-funded. They have found grant dollars or other kind of cheaper capital ways of growing. If you've gotten to a meaningful size business where we're going to invest by and taking on very little capital, that's a great sign of a good business model, a good entrepreneur, and something that we want to be involved with.
As part of the venture capital sector, how important is it to Michigan's entrepreneurial ecosystem?
I think it's of utmost importance. And I think it's, you know, we as a state have historically relied on a few industries to kind of really help us grow from a state perspective. Mm-hmm. And I think VC, venture capital and entrepreneurship is one of the core ways, if not the key way, to diversify that economy away from a reliance on certain industries in particular. And I think without that economic diversity and without that economic growth in those diverse industries, it's going to be very hard to attract both the human capital and so extremely talented people to want to stay here or come here and keep people here. It's mission critical for me. Mm-hmm. And it's, I think, Evan and I would both say the reason we came to Michigan from the East Coast is because of that diversity and the opportunity to get in on the ground floor and help the state kind of diversify from an economic perspective.
It's also a really underserved segment of the market.
Yeah.
And so before companies get very large and have a lot of cash flow or have a lot of assets where a bank will lend against, there's just simply not a lot of capital available for young businesses and young entrepreneurs. And so it's a critical part, especially in technology companies, especially where you don't have brick and mortar to lend against where a bank is going to get interested. So we really bridge that gap, both on the early side, which is where Adrian plays, and more on the kind of that growth stage side, before you get to the point where someone says, there's a heck of a lot of capital available for a very large, successful business, right?
One of the views, fair or not fair, we could say even a criticism of the venture capital industry and of the tech entrepreneurship space more broadly, is the lack of diversity. Now, this new report from the Michigan Venture Capital Association said nearly $17 million was invested in Michigan startups led by a CEO who is a minority, is female, or identified as LGBTQ. So there is that. But how do you respond to that, is that perception that there's a diversity problem in venture capitalism?
I think you acknowledge it because it's true. I think that there is a problem. I think that there are a lot of statistics nationally. Look, I don't think this is a Michigan problem. I don't think this is a venture capital problem. This is a broader issue, right? There's a lot of statistics out there. If you look at Fortune 500 businesses, how many of the CEOs or C-level executives are female? How many are minorities? It's a vastly underrepresented population. Now, Michigan has some statistics where we're doing a little better than the national averages, but we have a whole lot more to do and a long ways to go. So the, you know, the first step is acknowledging it and realizing it's there. And then the next step is all of us who are in the industry figuring out ways of helping and improving upon that in the coming years.
Adrian.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with Evan said. It's one of the reasons why I really wanted the Michigan Venture Capital Association to focus on this. They started reporting these numbers last year and have continued to do so this year, so that we, to what Evan said, can reckon with that problem and figure out what we need to do better. And I think, to what Evan said earlier too, one of the realest ways to increase diversity from both an educational standpoint, to get them into our pipeline to be VCs or to be entrepreneurs, is by really finding them at their seed stages and saying, your idea is worthy and your idea is strong and it's good. Let's take a bet on you and see if this risk pays off. And if you make a few million dollars off of that, you've changed not just your life, but everyone around you, and getting those kids into college, getting those kids to take those other risks that, you know, risk taking is something that's only affordable for people who already have wealth. And we want to change the number of people who have wealth and what they look like. And I think venture capital gets you there.
Well, I think you've almost answered the question I wanted you to tackle at the end, which is the fact that, you know, outside of tech entrepreneurs or venture capitalists, why should the average Michigander care about the health of the venture capital industry here?
Oh, man, because it's a huge piece to the economy. It's a huge piece to diversifying the types of businesses we have here, the types of jobs that we have here. When we put dollars into a company, 100% of the time it's going towards job growth. It's going towards sales jobs and marketing jobs and development jobs. And, you know, that is a critical piece to having Michigan's economy moving forward and diversifying away from some of the industries that are having a little bit more of the challenges that we all know about, right? It's a critical piece to the next steps, and both from a diversity standpoint of diversifying the people involved, but also the types of industries that are kind of taking Michigan's economy forward over the next couple decades.
Yeah, I mean, and exactly what Evan said, I like to personalize it a little bit where it's, you know, one of your listeners has this idea that's just been sitting with them, right? And they just have to figure out if they can actually do it, either because they are doing something at work that's super inefficient and they're just doing the same thing every day and they know they can automate it. They know they can make, you know, a massive improvement on what they're doing, or they just have had an idea forever. I put the question to them, who's going to take that risk on you? If you're not already wealthy, if you don't already have a network of very rich people around you that can say, yeah, I'll write you a $50,000 check, because for me, that's not a real option. And so I ask those people, you know, and your listeners, who will take that risk on you when you want it? It's not a bank. A bank will never do that. It's us, right? We're the people that will take that risk.
Willing to roll the dice.
We're willing to roll the dice. Our business model is to probably fail more than we succeed in terms of the number of investments we have. And so that's our business model. We want to take that risk. There are definite problems with how you get to us, right? We should be better at it. It's really just a pipeline issue of how you access us. But once you get to us, We're there to listen. We're there to hear you out. And if you're not there yet, we're there to put you into resources that can get you there, that can take those even earlier stage risks on you.
It's a pretty small community of folks. Yeah. So we see people all the time that are a little early, but that we say, Adrian, this is a really interesting group of people, or this is a really interesting idea. You guys should tackle this, and he does that with other folks. And so it's actually a much more collaborative approach to this industry than you might think.
Oh, you've given us a real good understanding of how you water that entrepreneurial garden here in Michigan. We've been talking to Adrian Omer from Invest Detroit Ventures and from Plymouth Growth Partners of Ann Arbor, Evan Ufer. Thanks so much to both of you for being with us on The Next Idea.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. The clock is ticking on homeowners in Wayne County who've received tax foreclosure notices. They have until June 7th to either pay their taxes or sign up for a payment plan. Michelle Oberholzer is with the United Community Housing Coalition, and she spoke with Stateside's Lester Graham.
How many possible foreclosures are there in Wayne County?
In Wayne County, I believe as of April 1st, there were 25,000 properties subject to foreclosure. And of those, we believe that 17,000 are occupied. Depending on how many people are in those homes, we're looking at many tens of thousands of people whose homes are at risk.
Do you know how many of those are within the city of Detroit?
A majority of them. I believe 17,000 occupied was within Detroit.
Now, I've been told by more than one person keeping track of things that often payment plans are just a stall for the inevitable, people losing their homes. And the reasoning is, if they've not been able to pay their taxes for the last 3 years, how are they going to make payments on past taxes and still pay the coming year's taxes? What's your assessment of that?
Well, it's a valid point, and at the very worst, it might be worthwhile to provide housing to someone for a little longer to mitigate some of the destructive aspects of displacement and vacancies. But I strongly believe that there are solutions if someone is given good information and if programs are made available to them. So if you're dealing with a low-income homeowner, which many of these homeowners are, then what they could do is take advantage of a low-interest payment plan that would both take them out of foreclosure, cut the interest that they owe, and give them time to pay.
Right. It's a lower interest rate than it was.
Correct. And then simultaneously, they could start taking advantage of the poverty tax exemption, which is provided for by the state of Michigan, and the city of Detroit has a very generous program for this. Perhaps the homeowner qualified for this in the past, but they didn't receive it, and therefore they've built up this debt of delinquent taxes. But if they're able to couple that payment plan together with the poverty tax exemption, then that can be a plan to save the home in the long term.
But that poverty waiver is not retroactive.
Not at this time, no.
Right. I've been amazed by how many people, especially low-income senior citizens, don't know about getting a poverty waiver. It has to be renewed every year. They have to apply for it every year. Could you tell us a little more about that and who might be eligible?
Yes. I will say that the city of Detroit does have a generous offering for this. This is a state law that provides for the poverty exemption, but not all municipalities have a generous program, and Detroit's is you can get essentially 100% of your taxes waived other than the garbage pickup fees. But the problem that we've had is what you indicated, that not enough people seem to know about it, and also that it has been very difficult to get, and that even when you do get it, you have to get it every year. So we're looking at ways to streamline that, and the city assessor has made improvements just in the last year on that. But it's definitely true that there's an extreme lack of information. And some people argue that, we need tax payments and it's not right that everyone who's low income in Detroit should be getting these taxes waived. But we find that the taxes aren't getting paid anyway. And the consequences of the tax foreclosure are often far worse, both for the individual and for the community at large. You know, we see displacement result from this. We have people who are now in need of housing. They need public assistance. The house itself may become blighted and permanently vacant, which is terrible for the neighboring taxpayers, and it's a financial burden on the government who has to demolish it later on. We feel that it's great if people can pay their taxes. We emphasize it. We encourage it. We want to educate people on how to do that. But if they qualify for a tax break, they should take advantage of it. Detroiters see their president taking advantage of every tax break, so they feel they're entitled to do that too. You raised the point about how can this be sustainable, and we have seen for the first time in many years, the city of Detroit did a thorough reassessment of property values. And so from now on, hopefully property taxes are lower and more closely aligned with the actual market value of properties. The problem is these back taxes are still based on those inflated values. But if we can get those under control, then the new taxes that emerge perhaps are reasonable and affordable.
I understand your group, the United Community Housing Coalition, will be conducting door-to-door outreach and counseling for homes facing foreclosure. You're working with Loveland Technologies data, which identifies which houses are up for foreclosure. How many people do you need to visit these homes?
We need as many as we can get. You know, doing this work is a constant practice in acknowledging our human limitation. We cannot solve this problem. We don't have the ability to solve it for everyone who needs it, but we strongly believe that all the help that's available is an advantage, and every home that is preserved is worthwhile. So as many people as we can get and train and become informed about this issue, I think a lot of people care strongly about their neighborhoods and they want to get involved and they're aware of this issue, but it's so mysterious. You know, it's been going on for years. It's taking place in the privacy of homes. It's not often talked about. It's bewildering, and it's got all these shameful connotations and other issues. And it's very hard to find out, what can I do about it? How can I get involved? And so we're trying to ask for people who have those values to preserve their neighborhood to actually step up and take advantage of our information and yes, Loveland's technology to do this outreach.
How could someone volunteer if they want to help?
They should contact me, Michelle Oberholzer, at United Community Housing Coalition. We can schedule trainings, and we will have one this Thursday at 10 a.m. And hopefully we'll be able to schedule more if the need is there to get people ready to do this outreach.
How many houses do you think you can visit?
Great question. Well, if you're working with a team of two and you're ready to go, you can visit about 10 in an hour.
Well, I meant overall.
Yeah, and we want to visit 5,000. I'm an eternal optimist. I think we can visit all 5,000 that we want to this month.
Are these high priority houses? Because you said 25,000 in the county, 17,000 in the city.
These are the highest priority, and it's really difficult to decide who is not going to get visited, but we do have to draw some lines somewhere. And we have sent mailers out to those houses that aren't on our list of those to be visited. But there's always those that will slip through the cracks, unfortunately.
I've got one more thing to ask you about, and you talked about this a little bit earlier. Loveland Technologies has been encouraging the Wayne County Treasurer and the County Executive, along with the Detroit Mayor, to stop auctioning up to the highest bidder these occupied homes, sometimes occupied by renters who are going to be evicted even though they've been paying their rent regularly. Does it make sense to sell to the highest bidder, who might be an out-of-town foreign investor, and then watch the house sit vacant for years, which, as you know, happens all over Detroit? Loveland is suggesting selling the homes to the people who occupy it, the renters. Can that work?
Yes, absolutely. It can work. I mean, I believe that owner occupancy is a really powerful tool that benefits the resident as well as the community at large. And we've seen studies that show in Detroit that more so than other factors, owner occupancy is an indicator of crime and well-being and health of a neighborhood. So yeah, we're proponents of owner occupancy here, and ownership and creating first-time homeowners is really wonderful. And I think that the system that we have now with the auction is short-sighted. You know, we get perhaps more money for the sale of the auction, but we have, in many cases, owners who don't have a vested interest in caring for the property or the people in it. So I believe that there absolutely exists a much better system than the one we have now. And the trick is trying to figure that out and being cautious about, if we're going to interrupt the system we have now, then we need to do it in a way that improves upon it rather than making it worse. But I refuse to believe that this is the best we can do.
Let's look at it from the other perspective. How does that make sense for county and city government?
Well, it makes sense in terms of retention of population. You know, we see 1 in 6 occupied homes becoming vacant within a year of a tax foreclosure. Many of the homes that we visit when we knock on doors are now vacant. I've actually met people who are packing their boxes, ready to leave, because they don't believe that there is an option for them to remain. And so if we're going to have a revitalization in the city, yes, we need new people, but we absolutely need to keep the people that we do have, both in terms of well-being and justice. You know, the government has to lead by example. So if we're going to punish people for not paying their taxes, we have to fairly assess taxes. And fortunately, we're starting to do that now. If we have provisions that reduce taxes for people who are in poverty, we have to make that available. And hopefully we continue to do better about that. Where there are provisions to reduce your taxes and get on payment plans and get information, we want to make it available. And yes, there needs to be a penalty if someone doesn't pay, because we rely on taxes to function as a government, as a city. But we need to do that in a way that doesn't pit the residents against this community and has a holistic vision where we can retain the people that we have in a fair way.
Michelle Oberholzer is with United Community Housing Coalition. Thanks for talking with us about this.
Thank you so much.
The Flint Institute of Arts has been a center for arts and culture in Flint since it opened its doors nearly 90 years ago in 1928. It's the second largest art museum in Michigan and one of the biggest art museum schools in the country, and it's still growing, still evolving. John Henry is the executive director of the Flint Institute of Arts. We spoke at the FIA the evening of April 22nd, and here's our conversation.
What is your personal mission statement for this museum?
Well, we're an educational institution, and it's our intention to bring the finest quality art experiences and art programs in the form of exhibitions, educational programs, special events to the entire community. So all ages, all walks of life, all backgrounds.
How do you feel this museum reflects Flint?
Well, you know, I think this museum reflects Flint like museums across the country reflect the community that they serve. We're sort of a scrapbook of who lived here and what they collected, what they were interested in. We reflect the intellect and taste of those who lived here before and contributed their collections to the museum and who continue to collect and give today.
And there's some stunningly familiar names, as I learned, that have been contributors, names like Chrysler.
That's right. We have a big collection of Bernice Chrysler's American Naive painting.
And also some beautiful pieces of Chinese work as well. It really is something as you walk around the galleries and see what's here. And just even the history of the land we're on.
Well, this belonged to C.S. Mott. This was part of his farm. And in the mid-50s, he and other captains of industry got together and thought that it would be a wonderful idea to provide a cultural complex to complement the educational complex that's also down here with the community college and the high school, which is just behind us, and the junior high, which was just behind us. And so next door to us is the state's largest planetarium. Adjoined to that is the Flint Youth Theater. Across the street is the Whiting Auditorium. There's Sloan Museum of Natural History and Science. And then across the street on the other side is the Flint Institute of Music and the home of the symphony.
It just makes such a statement when you drive onto this complex.
I think it's very visionary. It's one of the reasons I was very excited about coming here, to be able to exchange ideas with other disciplines in the arts and have them so close and to be able to collaborate on so many things.
Now, I understand the school. Talk about the school associated with this museum, because I guess as long as you're potty trained, up to whatever, you can come and learn.
What makes you think you have to be potty
trained? No.
We serve everybody.
What kinds of things do you offer in the school?
No, well, you know, we did start as a school originally. Okay. Before we were a museum, we were a school. And we intended to set up a place where artists could come and meet other artists and work with instructors and socialize and advance their own work. And within 2 years, we began collecting. Well-intentioned donors started giving us works of art, and so we had to expand our operation to also care for collections. Mm-hmm. And we bounced around from one place to another as we kept outgrowing a facility until 1958, when we built this place that we're in today. And that's why a significant part of this building is devoted to art education in our studios. These studios go back to 1958, but again, the vision was big, and the ideas were big, and we continue to thrive. We've gone with an unbroken history of offering classes since 1928, and we're adding to it today.
Indeed.
We're adding a big class studio as we speak. We're in the middle of construction.
Let's talk about that, the new contemporary craft wing?
Yes.
What's going to be there?
Well, that's the reason we're building this glass studio because we were just given two collections. Coincidentally, they're related, but it's coincidental that we got them both about the same time. One is one of the most outstanding collections of contemporary ceramics in private hands. Half of it's been donated to us, and the other half's been pledged. And so we needed a place for it. There are over 400 works, and even storage was going to be a problem for us. The other collection is a collection of contemporary glass, and it too is one of the best in the country. And it's been purchased recently by a local collector who has not only donated it, but helped us build the new wing to house it.
And a makerspace is on its way.
Well, that's the glass studio. You're going to be able to come in and watch glass blowers making new objects.
That's addictive. I'm in for that. And you've got a big, big upcoming celebration of Auguste Rodin coming up?
We do. You know, I think most of your listeners have heard the name Rodin, one of the most important sculptors of the 19th and early 20th century, one of the most important sculptors in the history of art. At his peak, he was considered the greatest sculptor in the world after Michelangelo. So he had a traditional training, but he was working at a time when art was going through a tremendous change. He was working at the same time that the Impressionists and Post-Impressionists were making their paintings. So his work was expressionistic, broke a lot of the rules, and he remains a tremendous influence even today.
Next year will be the 90th anniversary. What's your vision for the Flint Institute of Arts into its next century?
Well, again, I think we want to stay the course of being an important educational institution, bringing things to this community that they wouldn't be able to find without us, bringing things from far away that not everyone can travel to see. Our exhibitions are important, our educational programs are important, our collaborations with our colleagues across the street and around town, the universities, the hospitals, we're involved with them as well. We want to remain a vital part of the community.
And it is. It's a cultural gem. And again, thank you for the hospitality and for having us
here. Well, you're very welcome. Thank you.
John Henry, Executive Director of the Flint Institute of Arts. Thank you so much.
The exhibit, Rodin, The Human Experience, runs until July 30th at the Flint Institute of Arts. Today's program was directed by Ellie Billings and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, Cass Adair, and Lise Mesmer. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.